For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Well, I guess this brings us back to Luke chapter 23, doesn't it? We talked last week about the cross of Christ. One of the things we learn in the Bible, we're going to talk about the people around the cross this week. One of the things we learn in the Bible is that God is the one that takes initiative in love giving. He doesn't wait for us to come to Him and figure out how to breach the gap between us. God is a God of love such that He devises a plan and He takes the first step. In 1 John 4, John says, it's not that we love God, but that He loved us and gave Himself a ransom for our sin. Nobody ever asked Jesus, what would you think about dying for our sin and making it possible for us to get back to God that way? That wasn't our idea. That was His idea. He had developed this plan before the foundation of the earth. He planned it. He carried it off. He did everything. What's our part? Our part is to respond to what God has initiated. We read in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, no eye has seen, no ear has heard, no mind has conceived what God has prepared for those who love Him. It comes to us as a complete shock when we discover that God has already taken the initiative and already done the work. Then the ball comes back into our court. Are we going to respond to what Jesus has already done for us or not? As Jesus was dying on the cross, there were people already responding all around as they watched this awesome event occur. And I think we find, as we look at the responses of the people around the cross, their responses are typical of the kind of responses that people still have today, which I may be having. So let's think through several of these in a little bit of a metaphorical sense and ask ourselves, what can I learn about typical human responses to the initiative of God's love? The first one we want to look at is Pontius Pilate. We can read the historical account in John 19, where he says they led Jesus, therefore, from Caiaphas, that's the chief priest, to the praetorium, and it was early. They themselves did not enter into the praetorium in order that they might not be defiled and might eat the Passover. Well, Jesus had already eaten the Passover with his followers on Thursday night, and we saw that Passover starts in the evening and ends in the evening. What Dr. Honer has shown is that because of congestion in the temple, that they had set up a system where the northern Israelis would have Passover the first night, and the southern Judean guys would have it the second night, and that way they could handle everybody, kind of went in shifts. These people who had arrested Jesus were Judeans. Jesus and his followers were Galileans from the north. So they had done theirs the night before. These guys had yet to have their Passover this night. That explains that. Pilate therefore went out to them and said, what accusation do you bring against this man? They said, hey, if this man weren't an evildoer, we wouldn't have delivered him up to you. It's a little vague. And Pilate therefore said to them, take him yourselves and judge him according to your law. See, they had jurisdiction. They had a court. They could sentence people to floggings, to imprisonment, but they weren't allowed to execute anyone. And we know that that is true historically, which shows that the author of this book was not some distant, 200-year later inventor of the story, but it was somebody there who knew the legal conditions of the day. Well, they said, you are the one who has to put him to death. And they said this, that the word of Jesus might be fulfilled, which he had spoken, signifying by what kind of death he was to die, because he had predicted the Son of Man will be lifted up on a cross and put to death that way, in the Roman manner. Pilate therefore entered again into the praetorium and summoned Jesus. He asked him, are you the king of the Jews? Jesus answered, are you saying this out of your own initiative, or did others tell you about me? Pilate answered, I'm not a Jew, am I? Your own nation and chief priests delivered you up to me. What have you done? Jesus answered, My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would be out fighting right now that I might not be delivered up to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not of this realm. Pilate says, So you are a king. And Jesus said, Yes, you say correctly that I am a king. For this I've been born, and for this I've come into the world to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice. Pilate said, Yeah, what is truth? And he turns around and walks away. When he had said this, he went out again to the Jews, and he says, I find no guilt in this man. We know about Pilate, not only from the Bible, but also from secular, non-biblical history. Tacitus, the Roman historian, mentions him and his family and describes his career. He also specifically says that Pilate crucified a man called Jesus Christ because they were having trouble with Christians in Rome, and Nero at the time was putting them to death, and he explains to his readers what a Christian is, and he says they follow this guy named Jesus who was crucified in Palestine by Pilate. So these are all historical true events that we're reading about. Josephus has a long article about Pilate and discusses his character, his antisemitism, his brutality. So he's well known to us. Interesting point historically, though, in this account is the timidity of Pilate, because he did not want to kill Christ. He was afraid of Christ, as we shall see. He was afraid he might be some kind of holy man. But he was bullied into crucifying him by the Jewish crowd. And it strikes people as odd that Pilate, who was so brutal and who had killed so many Jews during his tenure there as the procurator, why he would suddenly cave in and allow himself to be pushed by a Jewish crowd. We read about this episode in John, where we read that then Pilate therefore took Jesus and scourged him, and the soldiers wove a crown of thorns and put it on his head and arrayed him in a purple robe. They began to come up to him and say, Hail, King of the Jews, and give him blows on the face. We read this part last week. And Pilate came out again and said to them, Behold, I'm bringing him out to you that you may know that I find no guilt in him. And he thought maybe this would satisfy people that they roughed him up this way. Jesus therefore came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe. And Pilate said to them, Behold the man, Ecce Homo, which has become a well-known phrase in Latin. When therefore the chief priests and the officers saw him, they cried out, saying, Crucify, crucify. Pilate said to them, Take him yourself and crucify him, for I find no guilt in him. The Jews answered him, We have a law, and by that law he ought to die because he made himself out to be the Son of God. Well, when Peter therefore heard this statement, he was more afraid. And he entered into the praetorium again, and he said to Jesus, Where are you from? But Jesus gave him no answer. He stood there. Pilate therefore said to him, You don't speak to me? Don't you know that I have the authority to release you and I have the authority to crucify you? Jesus answered, You would have no authority over me unless it was given to you from above. As a result of this, Pilate made efforts to release him. But the Jews cried out, saying, If you release this man, you are no friend of Caesar's. Everyone who makes himself out to be a king opposes Caesar. When Pilate therefore heard these words, he brought Jesus out and sat down on the judgment seat. It's interesting, this phrase, if you release this man, you are no friend of Caesar's. And one of the things that was going on right at this time is that there was a guy in Rome, a freed slave named Sejanus, who had been put as sort of an administrator over the Roman government by the emperor Tiberius. And Tiberius withdrew onto an island and lived with riotous orgies out there. He liked to party. And he just left this Sejanus guy kind of running the empire. At a certain point in time, people made it clear to Pilate that Sejanus was trying to organize a takeover of the Roman Empire, that he had decided, what do we need that drunk partier out there? I'm the one running the place. So he figured he would take over. His plot became known to Tiberius, who rode in with soldiers, captured him, and put him to death. And then he began a purge of all of the people that Sejanus had appointed to different government posts, most of them with the understanding that when the revolution comes, remember who put you there, you owe me. And Tiberius, in a real bloodthirsty way, went around and started capturing all these people and putting them to death. Thousands of Romans were executed in this purge. One of Sejanus' appointees, Pontius Pilate. And so as the word spread over the next couple of years, as this purge was going on, Pilate was probably pretty nervous, knowing that, you know, the other 2,000 people this guy appointed are all dead now. And so I think it accounts completely for why they were able to intimidate Pilate with a statement like this. They're basically saying, don't make us go to Tiberius and tell us that you're acting in a way that's unfriendly toward him, you know, that you're sticking up for traitors out here. And in this particular situation, we can see where Pilate, who normally would have told his army to run him down with spears at that point, instead seems to wither and back off and give them what they want. Sejanus, by the way, discovered in 32 AD. You can read Gary's paper about this on the website, Sejanus and the Date of the Death of Christ. That favors strongly the 33 date for the death of Christ rather than the 30 AD date that has been popular in previous years. More and more scholars are shifting to the 33 AD date as the preferable date because of this story right here. Anyway, that's for those of you that are interested in history and chronology. He takes him out and he sits down in the judgment seat. While he's sitting there, he gets a message from his wife, saying, she says, have nothing to do with that righteous man, for last night I suffered greatly in a dream because of him. And so she's getting bad vibes too. We shouldn't be killing this guy. So Pilate's own conviction was, he's not guilty. He should not be executed. Now his wife says, I had a dream, that man is a righteous man, we should not be killing him. The evidence was there. Pilate knew at this point right from wrong. But we read in verse 24 of Matthew 27 that when Pilate saw that he was accomplishing nothing, but rather that a riot was starting, he took water and washed his hands in front of the multitude, saying, I am innocent of this man's blood. See to that yourselves. And so we have the phrase, I wash my hands of that, meaning, you know, I just disown it and I'm not responsible for what happens there. When we think about Pilate then, theologically, we realize, first of all, he did have the power to decide. The Jews were not permitted to crucify. They had to have direct permission from Pilate. And so, regardless of whether he washed his hands or whatever else he said, he was the only one who could say, no, he will not be crucified, or yes, he will. And it's impossible to get around that central fact. We realize as we read these accounts, he feared Christ superstitiously. He was afraid he was some sort of a man of God. But not that he wanted to trust him, not that he wanted to know what he had brought. There's no suggestion, you know, when he says, what is truth, he turns around and walks away. He wasn't interested in the answer. So it's interesting that Pilate is probably like a lot of people today who would say, yeah, I believe in God. Well, what do you think about him? I don't know. And it's clear, yeah, there's some belief in some distant God out there, but as far as seeking to have a relationship with him, as far as making him a part of my life, as far as discovering his plan for my life, No, I haven't really looked into that. I haven't thought about it. We did a series of interviews for a movie we were making where we went down on the street on campus and asked people, do you think there's going to be an afterlife? And they'd be like, yeah. Do you think you're going to go there? Do you think you're going to be like in heaven or something? And they'd be like, well, yeah, I guess. And we'd say, well, why do you think that? And he'd be kind of like, I don't know. I've never really thought about it much. And, you know, you hear that and you think, what? You've never thought about it? Then, you know, you look around and you kind of notice people seem to be dying in this world. This might happen to me. How can you not think about it? It's usually because we don't want to think about it. And so there's this thing where people get into where they do believe in God, and yet they don't really have anything to do with him on a relational basis. They haven't drawn close to God. He's just out there as an idea. Pilate was kind of that way. He definitely didn't want to make the decision about what he was going to do with Christ. And we see indecision and evasiveness and efforts to release him, kind of half measures, well, we'll just beat him up and that ought to be good enough. And yet, in the end, he was forced to make a decision, and he made the wrong decision. There again, I see a parallel, I think, between the way a lot of people react toward the decision before us. What am I going to do about the cross of Christ? And there's often an effort on our part to sort of think about it and yet never really come to a decision. It's possible to go on for years, literally, in indecision. Sort of thinking, maybe I will, maybe not right now. And in that condition, we can stretch it out, perhaps for our entire life. We read that he wanted to please other people. In Mark 15, his motives are disclosed. It says, and wishing to satisfy the multitude, Pilate released Barabbas for them and delivered him up to be crucified. In the end, he's quite passive, isn't he? He doesn't really step out and decide what he needs to do with his life based on what's right, but he allows himself to be pressured into a decision that is the wrong decision. Of course, he tried to deny his responsibility with the washing of the hands, but nobody is fooled. He was definitely the one that made the decision. He is the one that's responsible. And so when we apply this, then, I think Pilate stands for some very common and typical problems people have. First, indecision, that refusal, that sense that, you know, I feel like maybe I should receive Christ. Maybe I should respond to the gospel message, but I'm just not sure. And so in that state of indecision, which can go on for a long time, we put off making a positive decision. One guy told Paul in the book of Acts, King Agrippa said to him, you know, Paul, you almost convinced me to become a Christian. Well, you know, there's a big difference between being almost convinced and actually being convinced. That's like night and day. And what God calls for from us is a direct and positive decision. Will you or will you not submit yourself to the work of Christ? We think... Sometimes it's people. I talk to people who feel like, you know, they seem to feel that someday there's going to come this point where I'm just going to know it's right. And you know, that day may never come. If you're waiting for this overwhelming sense that, oh yeah, okay, now I'm ready to decide. That may never happen. The decision isn't going to come from outside and be imposed on you. You just have to make the decision. And there may never be a time when it's any easier to make than it is right now. If we're waiting for it to get easier, we may be waiting the rest of our lives. We see in Pilate this desire to please the multitudes, and so many of us in confronting what Jesus has done, confronting the awesome story of the cross, are moved in our hearts and we sense, maybe God has done this for me. Maybe I should call out on him and call him on his promise that if anyone comes to me, I will not cast him out. But then the next thought that starts to occur to us is, boy, Dad is really going to think this is stupid. I know how he feels about Christians. And then, you know, what about my girlfriend? I don't think she's going to be pleased. Or the people at the office, I can hear all the jokes and the snide comments. You know, and so we start thinking, all of a sudden we're thinking about, we picture ourselves being a Christian believer, and then we start thinking about all these other people and what they're going to think about it. And sometimes that alone is enough to back us off. And we're like, I'll think about this later. How much of our lives are we really willing to see determined by the opinion of other people? That's the question. When will we finally reach a point where we realize, this is my life? I have to make the decision where I'm going to go, and I got to let the chips fall to have the courage to make the decision that we know is right. And of course, as far as his desire to shrug responsibility, certainly that's something that a lot of us can identify with too. So often people will come up to the decision to follow Christ, and they'll start all of a sudden talking about the cruelty of the nuns in my school, or the way my parents treated me, or how I've gotten the shaft in different ways in my life. And what you realize is happening is that we're looking back into our past lives and negative encounters we've had with religious extremists of different kind, and we're compiling excuses for why I'm not making the decision that I know I should make. The truth of the matter is, when we come before God, we're not going to be able to say, yeah, but God, my parents, or yeah, but God, this priest, or these people over here. None of that is going to matter. The only thing that's going to matter is, what decision did you make? You say, well, I never did decide. That's kind of a decision of itself. You know, if you fail to decide for God in the positive sense, just that failure to decide really becomes a decision at that point. That's the same as saying no. Jesus said, either you gather with me or you scatter without me. He says, everyone has to decide what they're going to do about the cross. Pontius Pilate. Well, let's think about another figure here. King Herod. This is not the Herod that killed the babies when Jesus was born. This is his nephew, a subsequent king, who was given jurisdiction over an area there around Palestine. It turns out that on the night that Jesus was being crucified, Pilate happened to be in town, visiting in Jerusalem. And so when Pilate found out that Jesus was not a native of southern Israel, Judea, but actually came from northern Israel, Galilee, that was Herod's jurisdiction. So he says, oh, I don't have to decide this at all. I'll just send him over to Herod. So he had his soldiers take Jesus in chains over to Herod's palace there in Jerusalem. We read about the encounter in Luke 23, verse 8. When Herod saw Jesus, he was greatly pleased, because for a long time he had been wanting to see him. From what he had heard about him, he hoped to see him perform some miracle. So, Jesus' reputation had spread. Everybody had heard about this guy that's going around and performing miracles, and Herod was like, oh, goody. We needed some entertainment tonight. Maybe he can do something for us. He plied him with many questions, but Jesus gave him no answer. And meanwhile, the chief priests and teachers of the law were standing there vehemently accusing him. So Herod's like, we got a small pool here, Jesus. The word is you walk on water. You know, if you could just like do that, I'd really like to see that. And apparently he tried to goad him into showing him a miracle. He wanted to see a miracle. A lot of us are that way. We'd love to see something cool like that. You know, let's fly. Let's see you fly. I was always that way as a non-Christian. You know, I'd be like, okay, you say God is real? God caused cats to fall out of the sky. I'm ready to believe. I don't think I was very serious, you know. A lot of times we have this feeling like God is, you know, in the medieval world, they used to have these things called court jesters, who were little guys that would dress funny and go flopping around on the floor and doing stupid things, and that entertained the king. They'd have them at the court there. And so it was good entertainment. It was funny. But you know, God says, guess what? I'm not your court jester. I'm not here to entertain and show you cool things for your idle curiosity. And so we read, after Jesus refused to do any miracles and would not even speak, just stood there the whole time, they got mad. And Herod and his soldiers ridiculed and mocked him. Dressing him in an elegant robe, they sent him back to Pilate, saying, this guy can't do anything. Well, so when we think about that reaction, I think, again, we can identify probably with what Herod was doing. He sees Christ as a chance to be stimulated, maybe entertained, or to be pleased. You know, it's like God is there to do something for me. And a lot of people want to see something. They want to see a miracle. You know, it's kind of like In Search Of. We want to see the supernatural. But again, it's not because we're engaged on a moral level. There's no sense of moral desperation. God, I need you. I need you in my life. My life is bankrupted spiritually, and I'm empty. Please help me. No, that's not really the nature of what's going on. It's more idle curiosity, like, yeah, I'd like to see something cool. And so it's a very distant, uncommitted type of curiosity. It really amounts to an arrogant attempt on our part to make God serve us. We would like God to show up like a butler and give us the thing we need. You know, so often we run into students who never have anything to do with God in their lives, but once in a while, you know, they haven't studied for the midterm or whatever. It's like, God, come on, help me with this. And so God is supposed to show up and help me with my midterm and then leave and get out of here afterwards so I can carry on with my life. We want this distant relationship where we know God is out there, but he's not really a part of our daily living, and there is not a deep personal relationship there between us and him. To that proposition, Christ answered him nothing. And so there was utter silence. And there will be silence from God in our part too. God can see not only the words that we're speaking, but the attitude behind it in the heart. And God looks right into that. He knows whether we're serious or not. He knows whether we're sincere or not. And when we're not, when it's idle curiosity, we are nothing. Well, that angered him. So he mocked God at that point, and of course at this point the blanket is thrown back and we see Herod for what his real attitude was, that he was just as prepared to sit there and be and mock and ridicule Christ as he was to be entertained by him. Well, let's talk about the thieves. There were two thieves crucified with Christ. We read the account in Luke 23:33-43. We read that when they came to the place called the Skull, there they crucified him along with two criminals, one on his right, one on his left. The criminals who hung there hurled insults at him. Aren't you the Christ? Save yourself and us too, while you're at it. But the other criminal rebuked him. And by the way, this other criminal, apparently earlier, he had been insulting Christ too. If you read all the accounts, at first both of them were hurling insults, but one of them realized this was wrong and stopped. He said to the other criminal, "Don't you fear God," he says, "since you are under the same sentence? We are punished justly, for we're getting what our deeds deserve, but this man has done nothing wrong." Then he turned to Jesus and said, "Remember me when you come into your kingdom." And Jesus answered him, "I tell you the truth, today you will be with me in paradise. So one of the thieves on the cross apparently may have been the first human being to take advantage of the cross, was this thief. He's an interesting thing, character to think about. On the case of the mocking thief, he wanted to be saved. He was really saying, save us, to Christ. But in what sense? Again, not a moral, not a salvation of moral content, but more a temporal salvation, like the student saying, help me pass this test. You know, get me out of this bad situation, God. They say in warfare that there's such a thing called foxhole religion. You know, that in the foxholes there are no atheists. Everyone starts to pray under fire. But shortly afterwards, it's like, you know, what? And we've forgotten all about that. It's a temporal type salvation, temporal in the sense of the here and now, but not a moral, spiritual salvation in the sense that, God, I'm lost and I need to be rescued by you from the fate of eternally living without you. In the case of the repentant thief, I think it's a very interesting case. This guy never joined the church. He did no good works. That's very interesting. By his own words, he deserved to be executed. So this guy must have been a pretty bad player. He apparently had killed people. He definitely was a robber. Not what we would consider a good person. He was a criminal and lived a life of crime. Now, some people think, well, if you do some bad things, then the important thing is that you have to also do some good things. So like, yeah, I did some bad things, but lately I've done these good things. And so it's like I'm going to put the good things on one side of the scale and the bad things on the bad side of the scale. And hopefully my good deeds will outweigh my bad deeds, and that way I'll get into heaven. God doesn't look at it that way. You know, to God, that's sort of like, that's sort of like the student who gets caught cutting school, and they confront him and they say, hey, you cut school today. And he's like, yeah, but what about the other 4 days this week I didn't cut then? Right? So what? You're supposed to go to school. The point is you did cut today. You know, it's like, you murdered that guy. Well, yeah, but how about the 300 people I walked by today that I didn't murder? What about that? It doesn't matter. That's the way God looks at it. The good things you did, you were supposed to do those things. What about the transgressions? What about the other things? Who's going to answer for them? That certificate of debt we talked about last week. What do you do about having the fact that God has a list of certificate of debt of wrongs that you've committed in your life and that you have to answer for? Is it that you have to make up for them and atone for them by good works? That's not the Bible's teaching. The Bible's teaching is that the key is to have that certificate of debt nailed onto the cross of Christ and let him pay for it. This guy certainly never had any opportunity to go out and be a good person. From the moment that Jesus said, you'll be with me in paradise, until he died, the guy was doing nothing more than hanging on a cross. And that should be, so that's a powerful case study. He was never baptized. So many people say, well, you can't get to heaven unless you're baptized. I guess Jesus must have missed that part. Because he says, you're going there. Yeah, that's really not what the Bible teaches. Truthfully, what he was an utterly helpless person, and he knew it. That's what we are too. When it comes to pleasing God, when it comes to getting back and forming that relationship with God, we are helpless. When it comes to standing judgment before God, the Bible says we're all helpless, that every one of us has fallen short of the glory of God. And so we need to admit that fact and turn to Christ like this man did and throw ourselves on as essentially on his mercy. And at that point, Christ says, this day you'll be with me in paradise. It's really a strong statement of the grace of God, the free gift of God, that we can't earn in any way, that simply has to be taken from him on faith from people who don't deserve it. What really the man had was an attitude. And that attitude, that willingness to come to Christ in humility, not to plead like, you know, Jesus, I'm really not that bad. You know, as he's hanging there, if you knew me well, you'd realize I'm not all that bad. Now, that wasn't his plea. His plea was, I deserve to die, but what about mercy? And Jesus immediately granted his prayer. Well, there was one other person of interest, I think, a guy named Barabbas. Barabbas was also a criminal. He had murdered people, and he was scheduled to be executed. We read about it in Luke 23:13. When Pilate went out to the crowd with loud shouts, they insistently demanded that Jesus be crucified, and their shouts prevailed. So Pilate decided to grant their demand. Once a year, they had a custom, though, of releasing one prisoner, an act of clemency, to sort of warm up the relationship between the government and their subject peoples. And so he offered to release Jesus as that one man this year that gets released. Instead, they cried out, release Barabbas, give us Barabbas. And so he released the man who had been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder, the one they asked for, and he surrendered Jesus to their will. So Barabbas, a guy we don't know too much about, except what it says about him here, was released that day and walked out a free man. When we think about this, we realize that the cross that Jesus died on, him being arrested late at night, in all probability had been built not for Jesus, but for Barabbas. At the last minute, Barabbas pulled out of the way, and instead of him being nailed onto the cross, Jesus was nailed there instead. It's hard to miss the metaphor here, is it? He was guilty. No one disputes that, not even Barabbas himself. He was a killer. But at the last moment, he was substituted for, and instead of him going to pay the penalty that he owed, this awful, grotesque death by crucifixion, suddenly Jesus was substituted for him. And so Barabbas becomes sort of a picture of you and I. We're the ones who should be put on that cross. But instead, we find Christ put there. They made a movie about this. The movie's title, Barabbas. It's one of the older movies. I think it's a Roman Catholic interpretation. It's kind of good. Anthony Quinn is Barabbas. And this is a scene from that movie where he is suddenly informed you're free for no reason. He has no idea why this has happened and goes out and follows Jesus to the cross.
Set free.
Set free?
You ought to know the custom of the season. The governor offered him either the prophet or you. He listened to the voices that chose you.
Huh?
I make no comment. Come on, get on the move.
All right.
Move on.
No killing Barabbas. No death for Barabbas. He died in my place. The death has been paid.
Well, you'd have to watch the whole movie to get the full feeling, but and it's kind of cool as he realized what had happened and had no idea why. Wonder why that slide got stuck there. Why don't you guys see if you can forward it? Ah, yes. Wouldn't that be weird to be Barabbas, you know, and be sitting there, this is the day of my death, you know, and all of a sudden someone comes in and says, hey, you're out. And it's like, what did I do, you know? Nothing. Barabbas did nothing. And without the slightest bit of deserving, all of a sudden he finds himself out there and here's this other guy being nailed onto his cross. Boy, that would be an experience. It's kind of a cool theme for a movie. And really, this is the ground that we find ourselves on. Christ carried the cross that was made for another. And so Barabbas becomes symbolic of you and I. He was guilty, but Jesus substituted for him at the last minute. Just as he is willing to have that substitutionary death go in our place, and instead of us going to divine judgment, we can have Jesus going in our place. That price has already been paid. It's too late to say, no, don't bother. He's already done it. The question is, am I going to take advantage of it or not? He can substitute for us as well. So let's see then, let's apply this and make sure that we're understanding exactly what these people around the cross have to say about us. We too here could be viewed as people around the cross. We know the story, we look at the cross, and now we have to react to it. This is a famous Rembrandt painting called The Raising of Jesus. And in it, it's a little hard to see background, but there's a crowd here, and the men are pulling Christ's cross up to put it in its hole. And in the painting, it's very interesting that with the lighting in the, right in the center, this guy here, art historians agree, is Rembrandt's own self-portrait. He sees himself as one of the ones that lifted Christ up on the cross. Why is that? Because the reason that Jesus was lifted up on the cross were my sins. It wasn't for his sins. It wasn't for somebody else's sins. It was for my sins. And Rembrandt understood this and drew this into his painting. In this sense, then, we are all participants in the cross. Today, we have to wonder, am I going to walk out of here, either on the one hand, maybe undecided like Pilate. Oh, that was interesting. Yes, I'm going to have to think about that someday. Are we going to take that posture? Will there ever be a time when we feel like, today, I'm making this decision? Let me suggest to you, no day will be any better than today. If you're going to make the decision, why not go ahead and do it? Don't continue to live in indecision between two minds. Maybe we walk away idly curious like Herod. Or do we want to walk away headed for paradise like the thief on the cross who was given that promise by Jesus Christ? Do we want to walk away rescued from what should be our judgment and have Christ substituted for us? Those choices, the kind of choices that people were making as they were around the cross, are still have to be made today, because we still look at the cross of Christ as the centerpiece of history, and we have to decide, how am I going to respond? The Bible calls on us very directly to make a choice. And that choice is to come forward and acknowledge, to believe, and accept that Jesus has paid this price. To turn to God and admit, I need to have my certificate of debt put on His cross. God, I'm not good enough to please You. Please let me be included in this work of the cross. Come into my life. Bring the Holy Spirit to live within me. We can do that at any time we choose. We don't have to go out and I talk to people, they say to me, yeah, but I have this habit. I don't know whether I can become a Christian because I have a certain habit I'm into. Don't worry about that. Don't worry about that part. Just keep focused on the issue. Do I want Christ to be my substitute? Do I want to accept the love of God into my life and let Him come and live within me and change me? That's the only issue before us. If you have problems in your life, if you have things that you're into that you know God would not be happy about, don't worry about that. You know, if God is real and He comes into your life, yes, your life's going to change. You'll see some changes in your life. And a lot of the things that you used to think were really cool, you're just not going to be interested in those anymore. You're going to have new interests that are more exciting, more fulfilling. You know, we can't think down the line and line all of those things up. Don't worry about those things. Focus on this question. Do I want Jesus to pay my debt and bring a personal relationship with God into my life? Yes or no? It's a huge decision. If you decide yes, this will be the greatest day of your life. And your life is going to change from this day forward. I'd urge you to go ahead and make the decision, and we'll draw the line there for this week. Let's turn to the Lord. Heavenly Father, we stand today around Your cross looking at this unbelievable act that You did. It's most incredible of all events. And we realize this took amazing, unimaginable love on Your part to be willing to go through this on our behalf. God, today in our hearts, we want to respond to Your initiating love. Not to turn up our noses, Lord. Not to walk away scratching our heads. Not sure. Undecided. Making excuses. Lord, today we turn to You and say, I accept this death. I want to be like that thief and say, Lord, have mercy on me and remember me. Because we know what Your attitude toward us is, God. As a God of love, You're going to be so happy when we make that decision to have our certificate of debt nailed to the cross of Christ. This is the reason You went through it, was so that we would take advantage of that. And many of us sitting here today, God, want to say, sign me up. Include me in the death of Christ. Come into my life with Your Holy Spirit. And let me experience this personal relationship with You beginning today and lasting for all eternity. We pray it in Christ's name. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.